So it's interesting what the situation you describe for India, because in many Western countries, the problem with the new generations is that they couldn't afford to buy a house, right? And that's something which also causes them some suffering, because they would really want to. There is still maybe also this kind of cultural conditioning, which suggests that if you want to set up a new family, if you want to have kids, then maybe it would be better if you own your house. But they can't, because the prices of housing in large cities in particular have skyrocketed, right? So that's also another reason why I think that we should pay more attention to real estate.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. We are all kind of frustrated about these guys telling us how to get rich, girls telling us how to make more money, how to save your money, invest in SIPs, get wealthy. At the same time, you watch all these stories, these conversations with how people became millionaires and billionaires. Then you talk about consumption and what these various symbols of wealth are, right? Whether it's getting new cars, whether it's getting new clothes, whether it's acquiring these new brands that sort of show people around you that you're arrived, with your Louis Vuitton bags, whether it's fake or real, no one's really asking, but people really know. So if you're that person with that little glimmery bag, which is glimmering a little too much, whether it's from Guangzhou or whether it's from Milan, who knows, but someone really does. But these are these traps that we all get stuck in. We hear about the rich talking about the rich, giving us advice how to become rich. We talk about the wealthy and they don't talk about us. They don't really talk about us. But then we talk about the growing divide globally, where people barely have food to eat, people who barely have money for heating, and people who barely have money to even drink clean water. And then you hear about the ultra 1% that is making more money than 99% of us combined, or maybe 50%. I don't know the exact numbers. Exactly. So if you say things like exact, you probably shouldn't be hosting a podcast. But hey, I am. Well, wealth is something that we all covet, we all talk about, yet we are warned against it in some of the most ancient texts. It is said, do not be greedy, do not covet, and do not hoard. Give back. Yet it seems that more and more people don't give back. The ones who do, God bless them, and I think we do hold them up and we appreciate it. But we seem to appreciate more the ones who are living glamorous lives and displaying their wealth for all of us to view. So talk about that, and to talk about what wealth means, what it means to be rich, what it means to be generationally wealthy, what it means to pass on this wealth, and what it means for us historically and also going forward into a world with increasing inequality economically, politically, socially. I've got Guido Alfani, who's a professor of economic history at Bocconi University in Milan. He's an author of multiple books. His newest one is As Gods Among Men. I've had a chance to read it. I would highly recommend it. But before that, do give this episode a listen, because I'm sure you will enjoy listening to the things that Guido and I speak about. Of course, I appreciate you being someone who comes to this podcast every week, listening to it, and to show my sign of appreciation, I would like you to go thanks. no, to appreciate it. I would really appreciate it, guys. Screw all the formalities. If you could go like this video, rate the podcast. Again, as I said it before, I will say it again. It goes a long way to help me and reduce the inequality in the algorithms. Hey, anyhow, but before that, enjoy this episode with Guido Alfani. Cheers. Guido Alfani, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It's a pleasure having you here today.
Thank you so much. The pleasure is mine.
I'm very excited to talk about the topic that you've written your new book on. Of course, it is something that everyone wants to dream of someday, being wealthy, unimaginably so, where you're like, I'm sneezing diamonds, you know? I mean, who knows? Each person has different dreams. But I want to ask you something which I've been thinking about, which was, when we look at historically, when we look at wealth distribution, we look at the idea of landowners and land workers, right? The feudal system, if you want to call it. There are various names given in various countries. But we seem to have moved away from that, right? Through capitalism, through industry, we seem to have moved away from the typical landowner and the land worker kind of model. But are we sitting in a more global model right now, where there is a repetition of the feudal system, but instead of land owners, land workers, it's these centralized figures who control power, whether it's the tech giants, whether it's the owners of resources, and that population seems to be shrinking. And the rest of us, the 95% or the 94% or whatever it may be, are the so-called land workers now.
Right. So as you rightly said, for a long part of our history, land and in general real estate has been the main component held. While today we tend to think that mobile wealth, so financial capital and other items of wealth, are more important. Now, this is true, this is correct in general, although I also have the impression that we tend to underestimate the importance of these kind of older kind of wealth, so real estate, because the interesting feature of land and real estate is that it is not going to easily depreciate, right? So that's kind of the most permanent component of wealth. And this is important, especially in some settings like the United Kingdom, for example, where there is still a landed nobility which continues to feature very prominently in the rich lists of the country, right? But then it's also true and quite clear that the nature as well has changed. And you mentioned these people who control big multinational companies. Their wealth is very difficult to connect to a specific place, not even to a specific country, which has the problem also of making it very difficult to assess how wealthy are the super rich who have this kind of wealth. And also, of course, has the problem of how to tax that wealth, because the more wealth is mobile, the more your wealth is invested in assets which can be easily displaced from one part to the other of the planet, the more you'll be able, if you want to, of course, to elude taxation, which, again, is basically the opposite situation compared to our past, when in many parts of the world, and definitely in most Western countries, land was the main item of direct taxation because it was very difficult to hide, right? So they were taxing wealth because it was relatively easy to assess, to observe, to estimate, not only because it was the main component of wealth and also the main factor of production from the point of view of being able to produce a revenue, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we are kind of in a complicated situation in which, of course, given the nature of wealth, it's maybe easier than at any previous point in history for that kind of wealth to become very concentrated in a few hands, to a degree of which we might not even be entirely aware of, because we can't easily observe that.
Yeah, I read a couple of things, right? One is that the top five billionaires in the world, and I think it was Bezos, Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, I think two others, I forget, I think the Jeffrey Arno or someone like him. And the fifth person was Larry something, I think the Oracle guy. I think the five billionaires made more in the past 3 years than 50% of the world's population, or the 50% of the world's bottom population in the past 3 years. Something like they made $3 trillion, and this group made, I think, $1.5 trillion collectively. And I was just like, yeah. Because it kind of, as I mentioned before we recorded, I live in India, which is an emerging market. Everyone talks about the strength of the middle class. And as you said, there's an aspiration to own land because it's solid. It's not going to vanish like maybe say a company you invest in which goes bust. But as a result, in a country with 1.7 odd billion people, there's not enough land for everyone, is there? I don't know.
Right.
So you see a lot of this corruption happening. You see a lot of middlemen selling the same piece of land to multiple people. Then you have within families inheritance being disputed. You have brothers killing sisters. You have husbands killing wives. It's horrific. The examples are there to view in the news every day. So then you kind of contrast that to the present, the Gen Z, and no one wants to buy. They're like, especially after the COVID pandemic, they're like, I'm not going to save up and buy, I'm going to rent. So I can get a much nicer house for paying rent right now than, you know, saving up 30 years and getting that piece of land, which then I can pass on to my child. So no one is thinking that far ahead anymore, I feel. That value of land being a sign of wealth, I think, I don't know if it's gone, but it's definitely shifting. So how have these symbols of wealth or these ideas of wealth generators, have they changed, if at all?
Yes. So it's interesting what the situation you describe for India, because in many Western countries, the problem with the new generations is that they couldn't afford to buy a house, right? And that's something which also causes them some suffering, because they would really want to. There is still maybe also this kind of cultural conditioning, which suggests that if you want to set up a new family, if you want to have kids, then maybe it would be better if you own your house. But they can't, because the prices of housing in large cities in particular have skyrocketed, right? So that's also another reason why I think that we should pay more attention to real estate than we do. So, you know, in that case, it's not a matter of choice. So in those settings, actually, the fact of owning your house, especially if it is a nice house, maybe in a nice suburb with a bit of garden, continues to be seen as an indication of some sort of social economic accomplishment, I would say. Then there are, also, of course, also other items of wealth, which today indicate, which level of wealth you reach. Then this, of course, reflects to some degree the fact that as you have greater availability of resources, you will want to buy certain items, but also to some degree, you want to signal that you have a certain status, right? So, for example, cars today are something in which really you can show where you belong, right? In the wealth pyramid.
Yeah.
A rich person might be able to buy a nice car. A very rich person, a luxury car. And then, of course, if you move up, if you get closer to the super rich, they will maybe own their personal jet or one yacht or two, right? So, still, these kind of items or transportation, if you want. So, technically, these are things you use to move around, but they change when you move up the wealth ladder quite clearly. And they also indicate where you belong. And you can call this conspicuous consumption, basically. It's something that to some degree may gives you a satisfaction, but it's also something which is meant to show to which kind of group you belong. And then, we should be careful. It's not like everybody it's not like all the very rich people are interested in showing off their wealth, but this also happens. So each individual has her or his own motivation. But then if we take the rich as a whole, you find these kind of commonalities which involve a substantial part of them. And the problem is also, not only to show off, but of course, if you have more money, what do you do with that? There is something to say for consuming it instead of simply continuing to accumulate it, right? So, what's better for society, whether the very rich consume more or whether they save more? There isn't a clear answer to this question, not historically, not even from the point of view of economic theory, I would say, but it's kind of a bit paradoxical situation, right? At least if you consider how society sometimes frowns upon the very rich and the super rich. So it frowns upon them if they show off their wealth by having a personal yacht or using a jet to travel, which of course, among other things, is also very very damaging to the environment, right? So now we today also have this specific concern, but at the same time, the maybe the main social problem would be whether they continue simply to accumulate and to become wealthier and wealthier without doing much with those resources, because their position compared to the others will continue to become even more distant. That's when really they can become as gods among men, as I say in the title of my new book.
And I find that is such an amazing social construct, right? Because we've collectively agreed that there are some goods, whether it's a Swiss watch, I mean, from Patek Philippe, mm-hmm. or a Rolex, or say drinking a certain kind of champagne, or driving a certain car, or a certain set of jewels from wherever the top jewelry stores are, or say, for instance, being a member to an exclusive club, or so many things, as you said, the private jet or the yacht. These are displays or the symbols of wealth. And what I find, and there's something else I read a few months back, is there is this absolute splurge that people are indulging right now, where everything is running short. Like Rolex is not able to meet demand. I think LVMH is not able to produce enough high-end champagne, because everyone's just like, I'm not going to save anymore. I'm going to spend and I'm going to live it up. So here are two things where I want to ask you what's going on. One is when you do have the money, right? When you have a lot of money, excessive money, and you decide to buy an extra apartment or your extra house or a house in the country, or decide to buy a helicopter because you want to go skiing for the weekend, whatever it may be, it's relative, right? I want to buy a watch, which I've been saving up for, but I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to save up. I'm just going to buy it. The other kind, I've come across a few of these examples, is when they don't have the money, but they have access to credit cards, or they have access to friends who have money. So to keep up this image, they get all these things. They get the fancy car. I mean, again, this fancy could be relative, right? For someone, it could be a Rolls Royce. For someone, it could be a Mercedes C-Class. For someone, it could be a Toyota. It depends. But I'm saying they get these symbols of wealth, relative wealth, on credit, and they don't have the money. So I remember an example of this where someone had a relatively well-paying job, and they had taken up all these things, a nice apartment in a good address, in a good condo. They had their kid going to a really good school. They had taken a loan on, everything was on loan. They had taken a nice car. They'd got this membership. They'd got that membership. Bam, COVID, the lockdown hit. The guy lost his job. He'd lose everything, because everything was on, he was in debt. So we have this one system where people spend excess money on these brands, on these symbols. But then you have the other people who spend just to keep up the appearance, when they don't really actually have the wealth or the money.
Right. No, that's a huge problem, a problem which has always been with us, right? So, I mean, of course, from the point of view, a proper definition of who is rich or wealthy, you have to look at what is called net worth, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to look at the net value of assets, and if you are in debt, the debt is detracted from that, right? So these are people who are not actually wealthy, actually not very wealthy, who, because they get certain signals from other side of society, step up their consumption because they want to be like this kind of models they have. Yeah. Now, this problem had been with us for a very, very, very long time, right? So this is one of the reasons why in Europe in the Middle Ages, cities established what they were called sumptuary laws, which actually were trying to contain consumption on the part of the very rich. So they were saying, okay, you can't have this kind of cloth if not in a given and specific moment, and you can't go and walk in the street with more than, you know, this number of jewels on your on you. And then the problem is, the problem is, okay, the reason for this is to avoid that other people become angry at showing how wealthy you are compared to them, and also to prevent them from, you know, becoming indebted, because they will feel like they have to consume like you. And then what happens in practice, unfortunately, for in some respect, is that these laws weren't actually entirely, you know, forbidding this. They were forbidding to do it, but what they could do was to do it anyway, to, you know, wear whatever they wanted and have as many jewels they wanted and to throw very lavish party and then pay a fine. And those who could afford it consumed very visibly how much they wanted and then paid a fine, and that was okay for them because they could afford it, right? Now, this is the Middle Ages, but in a period much closer to our own, so the years preceding the beginning of the financial crisis of late 2007, mm-hmm. which then triggered the Great Recession 2008, we know that, especially in the case of the United States, a problem was that many people in the middle class, actually, and even the upper middle class, were consuming more than they could. They were actually getting into debt. So they were, in that case, for example, also for including for buying the house, they were trying to buy a house which was nicer than they could have afforded because they were able to get loans and mortgages on a very cheap basis, right?
Yeah.
And then the society as a whole becomes very indebted, and when you have the kind of bubble bursting, they got into big troubles. You know, not only the poor, because we know that the problem there was also with people who were pretty poor and who were trying to buy the house and then they lost everything, but yeah. also the middling groups were experiencing this, right? And you mentioned the case of COVID, and again, in certain societies, that's the moment when this kind of issue becomes very visible. But the problem is always the same. People will desire what they see other consuming, and this is only human, if you want. That's a human sentiment. You know, we can understand that. Maybe we could say, okay, you know, it would be better to try and make your levels of consumption match your level of income, because that's a reasonable thing to do. But then we all, I think, can understand why one could be tempted, especially if the future looks bright, but could be tempted to try and anticipate about a bit the expectations of future consumption. And then if the future actually reveals not to be as bright as one expected, then you can really run into trouble. But what's the solution to that? It's very difficult to say, and it might well be that there is no solution as long as the differences in the levels of income and wealth are so high and continue to grow, right? So the point is, this is one of the reasons, in fact, why too high economic inequality within a society might lead to problems. There are many other reasons, but this is one specific reason why, right? You know, and then we have another point to make here, that's something which I studied specifically for Western societies, because then I was also looking in this book which I mentioned at how, for example, the Christian religion shaped these things from the Middle Ages on. So there was something which to me was kind of typical of Western societies, which is not to say that also others don't experience the same thing in a slightly different way. But the point is, if we look at the West, and I think it's not only the West, actually, right? But you know, I'm sure the West, so to say.
Yeah.
They are sometimes looked as heroes or superstars, which wasn't assigned to them in the past. I mean, if you look at the Middle Ages, from the point of view of medieval Christian theology, all the wealthy who were commoners, because nobles were not a problem, as you know, they had their larger access to resources because of God's plan, basically. But if you're a commoner and you were wealthy in the Middle Ages, you were by definition a sinner, because what was your wealth for? Why were you accumulating wealth which you could have used to help the poor and do some good, right? So by definition, you were a sinner, and it was also a very serious sin or a deadly sin, as the Christian theology would claim, right?
Yeah.
But you know, if you compare the situation with the one today, it's clear that we are much, 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 much more accepting of the presence in society of individuals who are super wealthy than, I would say, at any previous point in history. And we kind of are also more accepting of these people having an influence on culture, on society in general, on politics even. And this might also be kind of a problem.
You know, that's an interesting thing, right? Because every time there's been such, historically, every time there's been a heavy concentration of wealth, and when people have no food, and the same time they see a golden carriage crusted in diamonds driving past, the frustration and the resentment keeps building. And especially when you put it in the context of these people are sinners, instead of giving back to society, they're accumulating wealth. There's been a huge movement, right? Whether it's the French Revolution, or the Bolshevik Revolution, where it's more power to the people. Why aren't we seeing something like that now?
Right. And that's a great question. And that's, of course, a very big problem. Now, the French Revolution, interestingly, was about equality, right? So freedom, equality, and fraternity or brotherhood was, the keywords of the revolution. But that equality was first and foremost a political equality. So it was an equality of rights, right? It's only later that the problem becomes economic inequality. And from the 19th century, this becomes more and more clear. Now, of course, equality of rights and equality of access to political institutions and economic inequality are not entirely disconnected, because from the classical age, from the philosophers of the Greek period, like Aristotle, we know, and they were actually arguing that if you have a society, if you have a political system which is a relatively open one, like an early democracy or a republic, then if you have some individuals who are much, much richer than all others, you can't expect them to have the same access to institutions as all the others. And actually, Aristotle himself said, and I was taking this from my title, that these people would be as God is among men, right? Would be really overcoming all others. So the problem then becomes whether you can have in the context of something which is basically a democratic regime of some sort, if you can have to, in order to have real effective political equality, equality of rights, the problem is whether you can have a very high level of economic inequality. And you could argue that the answer is no, right? You can't, because then somebody will have a too large power to influence the political system. And taking again the case of the United States, this becomes very clear by the beginning of the 20th century. So after the 19th century, when you have the industrialization in the United States, when you have the Gilded Age, so certain families becoming extremely, extremely wealthy, and by the end of the 19th century, they basically belong to some sort of wealth aristocracy in the United States. And then at that moment, there is a, you know, it develops, there is a development of a very serious concern, both in the political left and in the political right of the time, about the fact that these very, very wealthy people who were already controlling the finance and the economy of the country might have taken control also over the politics of the country. So this is the debate about the so-called money trust, which supposedly was like controlling the American economy. And this is when they try and limit the power of influence of these super rich individuals, including by fragmenting their society. So the anti-monopoly, antitrust laws introduced in the United States also serve this political objective. So avoiding that some very rich individual or a group of them will be able to control the American politics. Now, are we today in the same situation as at the beginning of the 21st century? Well, from the point of view of the American society being accepting of super rich individuals who become directly involved in politics, we are in a very different spot. I would say today that's much better accepted. Donald Trump himself is a super rich. I'm Italian. And there is an Italian politician who actually started this new trend in super rich people becoming prime minister in the case of Italy, that Silvio Berlusconi won many times elections in Italy beginning in 1994. And he was the first super rich individual in any Western country who actually ran for top public post and he won the election. And I don't think, you know, whatever, you know, this is not a political argument. This is simply whether society would have accepted in an earlier moment a super rich with whatever political inclination, right? So simply for the fact that he was super rich as a good candidate for top public post. I don't think that in any Western country in the 1960s, somebody like Berlusconi or Trump could have won the elections, actually. Because the preferences of the voters were still very much for not having the concentration of political power and of economic power in the same hands, right? So the problem becomes, okay, but do we have that today? Because if we do, then we might have a problem.
You mentioned a funny, not funny, but it's an interesting thing, which is the tolerance of these people being accepted or tolerated in power, right? You said in the 60s they wouldn't. And now billionaires are standing and winning elections. But here's the flip side. In India, a lot of politicians, in fact, join politics to become billionaires. Yeah. That's the level of corruption, you know, because they join under this guise of servant to the people. But it's such a openly veiled system that it's a given that, you know, it's this demeanor of, oh, we are humble, we are the people's servant. But the amount of money that goes into their pockets is ridiculous and no one questions it, right?
Yes.
And of course, this is present across the world. Yeah, I'm just using India as an example because the rate of progress, the number of projects being commissioned, the number of amount of foreign investment is just quite large right now. And of course, a lot of people say there is an attempt at cutting corruption across the board. But, you know, you hear stories, of course, there's no hard example that I can present to you. But you hear stories which, you know, are pretty believable.
Yes. And sometimes people get convicted for, you know, for corruption and for having tried to line their pockets with that. Now, of course, yes, this is also something which has always happened. So we have on the one side the problem with the rich, well, the people who are already very rich, who want to get involved in politics. And on the other side, and that's a mirroring problem, that of people wanting to use politics to grow very wealthy.
Yeah.
You know, there are two faces of the same medal. And the problem in the end is always the same, that politics and wealth in a perfect ideal world should be kept as separate as possible, which of course is impossible, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when I say impossible, I could quote a 3,000 years old poem, the Babylonian Theodicy, which states that the king is the one at whose side the wealth walks, right? And this means there is really, you know, a connection between the king, so the sovereign, and the wealthy, because the king needs the wealthy and the wealthy need the king, right?
Yeah.
But again, there is still a difference between a system in which the politicians are one thing and the very wealthy are another, and they of course are connected somehow, and a system in which the super rich become presidents, prime ministers, and so forth and so on. Now, unfortunately, if we look at history, we find many, many, many examples of corruption and of the misuse of political institutions for the purpose of becoming wealthy. That's a specific path to wealth, which involves only a minority of people, but still is something that happens throughout history and which is particularly troubling, because that's another way in which wealth can alter the way in which political institutions are supposed to function. So that is, of course, a big problem. Now, one more thing on this topic, which is pretty interesting, is that very often we have many cases of extremely wealthy individuals who decide to become involved in politics, and very often they say, you know, with me, you know, I will not steal your money because I'm rich already.
I already stole it.
Don't need to do that. No, and many have said this. Unfortunately, you know, based on past experience and based on the court verdicts, we know that it is false. So, you know, human beings are human beings, and it's not that the very wealthy will always be like sheltered from the temptation of stealing money, because some of them will actually do that. They did it in the past. They've been convicted sometimes for doing that, and that's because in the end the super rich are no different than all the other people. They have exactly the same vices and virtues, only maybe they have a greater opportunity for doing, you know, both a lot of good and a lot of bad because they have more resources than the others.
I had this, you know, thought, and it's sort of something I put forth just for fun, you know, I mean, that there's, you know, we talk about the wealth tax, and I was thinking, you know, when you have a certain amount you make, like say you've reached 10 billion or you've reached 100 billion or whatever, you should have a certain number. And once you cross that number, everything should be taken from you and you should start from scratch. Because clearly you have the ability to make money. So once you make that amount, let's see if you can do it again. It's kind of like a challenge, right? Because it clearly is a human need and a sense of human greed. Because if you have enough money for the next five generations, why are we still hoarding wealth or accumulating more wealth? Like, what is this? Is there a historical, I mean, of course, there's a historical trend, but you know, there are books written about it, there are stories, there are poems, everything, that it goes back as far as humans go back. But I think you mentioned this fact in the book, this number, correct me if I'm wrong, which stood out for me, is I think where presently 1% of the population controls 30% of the global wealth and 5% controls close to 70% of global wealth. Is that, am I quoting that right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's just ridiculous. I mean, how much is enough? Because we're heading to this towards a horizon where the population's crossed 8 billion globally. Resources are reducing due to global warming. There is a big impact on the food system. There are certain climate patterns that are changing. So clearly there's an entire shift, and with this absolute concentration or inequality of wealth distribution, where are we heading?
Well, unfortunately, where we are heading is clear. We are heading towards an ever increasing concentration of wealth at the global level and within specific countries as well. This is really a clear pattern. Although, I mean, the string of crises of the last 10 years and more have sometimes slowed down this process, but they haven't inverted the process as previous crises did. So, you know, not even major crises today lead to this side effect of de-accumulating wealth from the hands of the few. So, and this, of course, is a problem, because this means that there is no reason to think that wealth will become on its own more evenly distributed, unless we decide that we want to redistribute it a bit, which would require to tweak the fiscal systems, to introduce some sort of tax on wealth, some sort maybe of taxation of inheritances, and this will, at the very least, make it more difficult for wealth to continuously accumulate, and making wealth less inheritable also, and we know this very well, both from economic theory and from the actual information we have about our societies. But if you make wealth a little bit less inheritable, that has a very important impact on the future generations, right? They will tend to be, you know, to start out on a kind of more even footing. Also because on principle, those resources could be used, for example, to provide better education for everybody, and in particular for the lower status. So those who would not be able to buy for private education. And this would also tend in time to improve social mobility and would contrast the this tendency for continuous inequality growth. Now, the problem there is that I don't see the signs in the countries which I know a bit about. I don't see the signs of this becoming really an effective political agenda in the near future. So right now, and this is clearly the case of Western countries, the debate seems to be about how to reduce taxation even more, how maybe to make taxation even flatter, which means, you know, less progressive and so less focused on the on taxing the rich than it was. And so I don't think that we are there yet. We might get to a situation in which inequality is so high that people actually start complaining even more than they have been complaining, especially during the crisis in the last few years, because they have complained and nothing happened, right? So
I read something shocking.
I
mean, just to add to that point, I read something shocking this morning about how in the present day Britain, in the UK, there is a resurgence of Victorian age diseases that is impacting the poor, like scabies and rickets and measles and things which were prevalent during Victorian England are now coming back and impacting the poor, like because of lack of sanitation, to proximity of living space. I mean, people are living too closely together, lack of hygiene, lack of fresh vegetables and fruit, lack of sunlight, and a rampant increase in sexually transmitted diseases. So we're seeing, and again, because of the living cost going up, because of the cost of food going up, everything going against these people who are already finding it difficult to find ends meet. And we heard of these stories. Of course, many people say, oh, India, you guys are used to it. I don't think anyone should be used to it. But of course, it is prevalent, the disparity in India. There is a huge population which is living under the poverty line. But when you kind of look typically to Europe or you look at to North America, you kind of don't expect this to collapse, right? Because at least a basic level, a basic standard of living, a basic standard of health, it seems to be crumbling. And that's kind of worrying. I mean, I'm not saying it's not worrying if it happens in India. It's worrying across the board. But the fact that it's happened so quickly over the past 5 years in, you know, parts of Spain and parts of the UK and the parts in parts of Italy as well, I've read somewhere, it's clearly the theory is no longer theory. It's actually being seen on the ground.
Yes. No, you are. I would say entirely correct. This is a problem across the board, and that's one of these apparent paradoxes. Right, we experience globally a continuous increase in the amount of economic resources we have available, in the amount of wealth, of global wealth, and at the same time we see that there are areas of the world which are not converging with those who are better off, or not at a pace quicker than a really a snail pace. And even if you look at some of the richest countries in the world, the United States is surely the best example, you see disparities in access to things like public health or to health more generally, which seem incredible because the United States could easily afford to provide decent health to everybody, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's difficult to understand why they don't do that. There is a cultural, a very important cultural side to that story, but still this is very, very impressive. Now, let me tell you a story about Europe and the US in the 19th century, which, you know, connects to this. Now, the problem in the 19th century in those countries was cholera, which unfortunately came from India. No, it starts going out of the Ganges Delta area in the first decades of the 19th century and then causes global pandemics, basically. So Europe is badly affected by cholera, and that's, of course, a horrifying infection. And then when from 1855, John Snow in London demonstrates that there is a connection between contaminated water, so using certain wells and the spread of the infection, there is this awareness that cholera spreads because there are parts of cities which are inhabited by very poor people who live in very poor conditions, right? And in that moment, faced with the fact that the deprivation of the poorest strata could cause a general problem, you have that the economic elites mobilize to improve the situation in cities for everybody, but beginning with the poorest, even if they didn't want to, because in some cases, their houses were literally razed to the ground to build better housing, and they were opposed to that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But in the end, even if, you know, even if these economic elites, I mean, some among them were actually fighting for justice and for, and they were genuinely interested in improving the condition of society. There is no doubt. But the reason why they could build such a strong political consensus to improve the situation of the poor was that, very simply, they didn't want to have cholera in their cities.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, maybe from that point of view, we might also be on the verge of understanding that if we don't do something to prevent the current trend to continue, then everybody is going to run into a problem, because it's not that, it's not like if you live in your nice villa in the suburbs, you will be sheltered entirely from measles, as you said, and other infections. I mean, I think cholera is maybe not very realistic in the setting,
but COVID showed us, right? That fear of COVID kind of leveled whether you had money or not, right? Of course, the extremely poor did have difficulty to access oxygen or whatever the scares they put us through, the fears they put us through, vaccines, whatever. But at one point, you could sit in your penthouse, but still you didn't know whether it was going to be transmitted or airborne, right? So that fear really leveled a lot of the wealth difference
to a certain extent. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you see that, again, in countries like the United States, in the end, if you see those who actually died of COVID or suffered permanent health conditions because of COVID, unfortunately, there was really a much higher prevalence among the poor than among the rich.
Yeah.
And that's the final outcome. And in the United States, that is particularly stark because they no longer have the kind of welfare state that still, to some degree, survives in other rich countries of the West.
What I find another interesting thing about, of course, when you talk about wealth, of course, they're the tools of wealth, right, which are your financial tools, which measure wealth. But there's also cultural tools that measure wealth. It's the kind of lifestyle you live. And, you know, when you look at the poor, the kind of food that they are marketed, the kind of lifestyle that they're marketing, it's almost promoting a continuing poor life, because it's poor mental health, it's poor physical health, it's poor because they don't have savings. And as a result, the cycle just gets worse, right? Because to kind of make ends meet, they end up eating all this really, really bad processed or whatever food, which makes it makes it harder for them to break that trap. And that's across the border, across countries.
Yes, it's definitely across country. And we see that in the West, that's easy to see in the obesity epidemic. So, you know, if you look at those who are seriously overweight in those countries, they tend to be predominantly people from the lower and the middle lower strata. Mm-hmm. Precisely for the reason that you mentioned, because they can get access to very cheap, highly calorific food, mm-hmm. which are very satisfying to eat also. You know, it tastes nice, but they are not as healthy as much more expensive foodstuff like choice vegetables and fruit, to which those who are better off has easier access. But also, as you said, and this is, I think, very important, those who are better off have been educated to eat that kind of food, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And this is increasingly important. So, and this, I think, has to do again with the fact that in some settings, in some countries, we have moved away to at least some degree from these ideas of, public education for everybody and some common ground, which was so clearly established when Europe was building its welfare state system. Everything is connected. I would also argue that all these trends together aren't necessarily in the best interest of the richest. It's not only a matter of, favoring the spread of epidemic diseases in your country. It's a more general issue, because a certain unavailability to help society, to provide for society, simply by, for example, accepting to be taxed proportionally more than others because you earn a larger income or have larger wealth, that kind of unavailability in the end is, I would argue, very probably going to cause social tension, and then nobody knows where that might end. And this is what history tells us very clearly. Every time the rich have been perceived to be insensitive to the plight of the masses, they have experienced violence to different degrees, even, revolution and entire upturning of political systems. Of course, in the context of a modern democracy, one would hope that when the situation becomes untenable, people would simply vote against the parties offering pro-rich political agendas. And that would be kind of the democratic solution to the problem, which, however, might be delayed if the super rich at the same time have really taken control of politics to a much greater degree than in the past. So the point is, if there is to be expected a change in politics, that's going to happen at a level of potential conflict which might be higher than would have been in a different context. And that's dangerous for everybody, I would say.
Because money and wealth can only isolate you from your surroundings so much, right? You can build a billion-dollar apartment tower next to a slum in Mumbai, or you can build a utopia getting together with other billionaires in California, which some people are planning. But if there's no food for people and the masses are struggling, I mean, no number of helicopter rides to the airport or private villas or private jets can escape. I mean, where are you going to escape eventually? You can build a colony on Mars, probably. But it's going to follow you. It's going to follow you there, right?
Yes.
When we were exchanging emails, I mentioned these two words, rich and wealthy. And you said that you use them interchangeably. The reason I mentioned those two words is it actually comes from a bit that a comedian, an American comedian, Chris Rock, I'm sure you heard of Chris Rock, he had this bit many years back, which was funny, but also brought to light a certain issue. He said, there's in America, you have the rich and then you have the wealthy. And of course, I'm not trying to do his bit. I don't want to ruin it, but just give you a sense of what he was trying to say, was that you have these celebrities, right? The NBA basketball players, the National Football League football players, so those guys are rich, but the guys who are signing their checks, they are wealthy. And he made it a race thing, right? And it was funny, of course, but it's also true, because I was reading about the musician Rihanna, who's made millions of dollars. But because, as you said, she didn't know, or she wasn't educated as to how to make that money grow for her. She didn't know that there was a certain way in which you can create that money into wealth, or that riches into wealth. She thought it's all about these symbols of wealth. So she spent it all. I don't know whether it spent it all, but she was misguided by a financial analyst. That's what she claims. So she's left with, she went into debt after that, because she bought all the best cars, the best jewelry, the best dresses, the best houses. And I want to just ask another, sort of tie in another point, which is, for a lot of people, they make the money and they spend their entire life spending that money back into the system. So it's almost like they've made nothing, because the system, which is geared to amplify the inequality, right, which is these fast food multinationals, these big companies which keep the poor unhealthy, but they also keep the rich, and not the extra or the wealthy, but it keeps these rich people in a trap, which is of constantly, today you have a BMW 5 series, tomorrow you want a 7 series, today you have a Rolex, and tomorrow you want a Patek Philippe. So it's a trap for a lot of people in different relative contexts of money or lack of.
Yes, it has been a trap for a lot of people across history, and the solution to the trap is unclear. So, for example, in Europe, when the nobility, the old nobility with feudal origins in the early modern period, had to do with all these commoners who had become very wealthy, wealthier than them, you know, they clearly couldn't keep up consumption to imitate them. And they said, okay, it doesn't matter how much you consume, but the taste which you show in your consumption, right? So they were, you know, also introducing fashion to try and kind of culturally control the proper consumption so that these people couldn't simply jump in and show off their wealth and say, okay, we belong to your group because we can consume more than you. No, it was also a matter of, you know, being able to. And this, of course, leads also to the big issue of education and how education can also be used to establish aristocratic dynamics, right? So you establish a situation in which it becomes difficult, even if you are wealthy, but you don't come from the right position in society, from the right family, if you want, it becomes difficult to join this wealth aristocracy because you will not know how you are expected to behave and what you are expected to consume, and then you didn't have the right life experiences, like you didn't go maybe to a private school with all the children of other wealthy families and so forth and so on. And this, by the way, will tend to stop social mobility across society. So that's a problem. Of course, you mentioned a case of unsuccessful use of a specific path to affluence, which is that of being a major artist, basically. But there are also many other cases which instead are success stories, right? So yeah, it's the same in the end with entrepreneurs. We remember those who are successful because they maybe introduced success with, you know, certain innovation or certain invention, and founded companies that they're still there, or that at least lasted for a long time. And we don't remember those who were almost there and then for whatever reason failed, maybe because a war began, or for whatever other accident of history or problem with the personal life. But surely, and this brings us to another problem, which is that of having inherited one's wealth. Surely, if you come from a social group or from a family in which there is an awareness of what should be done in order to, you know, preserve wealth across the generations, well, first you will inherit that wealth, so you will begin in life with an advantage, and then maybe, you know, you will still at the very least you will know what you are supposed to do. Then, if you choose not to do that, we might squander the family wealth and, you know, bring everybody back to a situation of much more modest economic position. But there is an issue with that, clearly, which is maybe a reason why in some countries there is this debate about introducing some degree of financial education in, you know, compulsory financial education in high schools, at least, you know. And this would actually serve also to solve the other problem you mentioned. So explain people that there is only so much you can expect to be really able to acquire by getting into debt, right? So this is also something that would be important from that point of view.
And, you know, I want to just talk about a couple of things before you wind up today. One is this idea of, you know, the social construct, the economic undertones, the political climate, all these things which are more perceivably linked with wealth and wealth generation. But there's also a human element, right? A psychological element. When I, as you said, I'm born to a family that is a little more well off. I have no worry about a home because my grandparents built a home, or I have no worry about getting into a good school because my parents went there, their parents went there. So the foundation is automatically a lot more solid and is better off than someone who didn't have that. But say that person has the drive, the human drive to make that money, and they make end up getting a job where they're making a lot more than, say, me. But still, there is a psychological difference between these two individuals, because one person is just secure. They've never seen a day where it's difficult, a day of scarcity. But the other person's working from a place of scarcity because he or she knows that if they don't put in 80-hour, 90-hour weeks, or they don't have that drive, they will go back to that poverty or that life which wasn't as good. So I don't know if I have a question, but which type of personality do we need going into this into this future where there's so much inequality?
That's a great question, because but that connects to even larger questions, right? Because one could say, okay, in a world in which, you know, let's presume that, and this is a, you know, kind of a very strong hypothesis in reality, but let's accept this hypothetically as true. So, you know, everybody is moving towards wealth, right? You know, there is convergence at the global level. Those who are worst off today will grow quicker, and blah, blah, blah. Let's hypothesize that this is true, which of course it is not, but, you know, okay. Then in order to avoid having inequality within this situation, and given that capital is becoming ever more abundant, so we don't really have any need to accumulate capital to invest, because, you know, there is already more capital than needed right now, it would be better then strictly that people simply spend.
Yeah.
Right? Because that would counteract directly the accumulation of wealth. And by the way, it would also arguably favor economic growth, because you increase the level of demand across society. But then the problem becomes, as we know very well today, that increasing consumption levels across the planet also increase the strain we put on our planet. So we would only make the ecological situation worse. We would bring forward climate change at a quicker pace and with greater intensity. And this then might backfire big time, right? So we all end up suffering a lot from this. And by the way, as climate change can be expected to affect unevenly different world areas, this would then maybe bring us back, you know, to a situation of substantial disparities between world areas. So, you know, there is again a paradox here. From my point of view, some sort of government-led redistribution, which, I mean, would be useful, because this would allow, on principle, to slow down the accumulation of wealth influence, to make wealth a little bit less inheritable. You know, I'm not arguing for very high taxation for the affluent, but simply a little bit more than we have right now. And if you look at taxation of inheritances, in many countries, we are at an historically very low level, right? So we are really moved away from a previous system. So if we do that, we would at the same time slow down this tendency for growing wealth inequality. And we could use those resources to speed up within societies and between societies convergence towards a better standard of living for everybody. Right. So I think that this is, this is what we should really think about. Of course, it's maybe more difficult today than in the past, because, as we said at the very beginning of this conversation, the nature of wealth has changed. Wealth is more mobile. It's easier to escape taxation. Right.
Right.
Which is also why I wouldn't personally suggest any very intensive form of taxation where patrimony are the most affluent, because I don't think that it can be achieved in practice in today's context. But something more than today, I would say for sure that's possible.
Yeah,
let's hope. We don't have the political consensus for that, which is the interesting problem we are faced with.
I think, we need more individuals to step up. But as you correctly pointed out, right, if everyone gets rich, I think the first thing you'll have to write a new book then called As Gods Amongst Gods, you know, because then there are no men left.
Yes.
So you'll have some work left your way to write a new book. But, you know, you hear some nice stories like the founder of the sporting wear company, Patagonia, right, where he gave up his position. I think 80% of the profit of the companies goes towards a trust to combat climate change. So I think people individually need to step up and kind of say, you know, I've made enough. I live a good life. Let me give back. And then we can probably see the real gods among men are the ones who give back and address hunger and the people who take care of others. But I don't know if it happens, it'll happen in my time or your time, but I hope it does. And, you know, one good thing is people like you bringing this to our attention, writing about it and historically, factually representing what's happened and identifying these patterns, bringing it to the forefront. And I think that's essential, because if we don't know, then how are we going to do anything about it? So I appreciate you taking the time, Guido, talking to me today, educating me, answering certain you know, questions which are a little difficult for people to hear. But I appreciate it. And thanks for being here today.
Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed the conversation, and thanks to all those who have listened to it.
Absolutely. And I will put the link to your book, As Gods Among Men. I read it myself. I've listened to it myself. There's the audio version as well. And I highly recommend all of you listening to go get a copy. And I think if we all have, you know, a sense of what has happened and what is happening and what's to come, I think it's a sense from what you speak about in the book is one is education, information, and also a sense of how much is enough, right? Because if we keep running after it till there's no end, then we're going to see this future where everyone's just going to hoard and be more greedy without even understanding, okay, this is enough. You know, I've got this, I'm living a good life, and let me give back.
Thank you.
Thank you, Guido. Pleasure having you on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you like what you heard, please do check out the other episodes on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. And I would much appreciate it if you could like the video, share it with people who you think might enjoy it. And of course, do subscribe to the channel, because it will help me and the podcast grow and reach more people just like you. So thanks again. Appreciate it. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you like what you heard, please do check out the other episodes on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. And I would much appreciate it if you could like the video, share it with people who you think might enjoy it. And of course, do subscribe to the channel, because it will help me and the podcast grow and reach more people just like you. So thanks again. Appreciate it.